Thank you very much for inviting me over here to spend a few minutes and talking about something that's very dear to my heart, and I hope by the end of this presentation today it'll be dear to your heart too. You know, as once said, the nations have passed away and left no traces, and history gives the cause of it. One single simple reason they fell is because they were not fit. Physical fitness, fitness in general, spiritual fitness, moral fitness, academic fitness. What do we mean by being fit? Without question, I would classify spiritual fitness as being the most important type of fitness. But I would challenge you to be physically fit along with your spiritual fitness and really enjoy a new dimension in life. At the present time, for example, we are preparing to break ground the 24th of March, 1976, 1977 rather, to build the new Physical Fitness Center at Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary in Fort Worth. We're hopeful that we will be able to integrate into their program at the seminary a physical fitness program, because it doesn't do you any good to develop spiritually unless you have the physical stamina and strength to go along with that. There are countries throughout the world that put a priority on fitness. For example, when I was traveling in the Orient in 1974, I noticed a picture of a large group of people assembled in Peking. Over 110,000 Chinese youth were being tested. Their physical fitness was being tested. And the late Chairman Mao was viewing their fitness, and the slogan underneath read, "Chairman Mao encourages the youth of China to get fit, to keep fit, and to spur on the revolution." I was in Russia in the summer of 1975 and had a chance to see what they do in building up the fitness of their people. I was in West Germany in 1975 and had a chance to see the physical conditioning and rehabilitation centers that they have in West Germany. Russia has over 2,000 conditioning and rehabilitation centers. Because, you see, you can't reach your optimum in life unless you have good strength to go along with that. You might say, well, I don't have to worry about that because I'm 18, 19, 20, 21, 22 years of age. Well, that's a misconception that a lot of people have. Because, you see, heart disease starts early. We can show in 10-year-old children that are killed accidentally that they have cholesterol streaking in their aorta. They have early signs of degeneration that occurs even at 10, 11, and 12 years of age. Studies done on American casualties killed in Korea in 1953, killed in Vietnam in 1970, average age 22 years, not 42, 22 years, and they showed that as high as 77% of those young men already had major signs of coronary disease. Between the years 1950 until 1970, the greatest increase in deaths from heart attacks in men in this country occurred between the ages of 25 and 44 years of age. No longer is heart disease an old man's disease. And along with the feminist movement that we have in this country, the acceptance of more job responsibilities by the women, the more smoking that we're seeing by women, we're seeing an increase in deaths from heart attacks in women. And if you're going to take some corrective action that's going to have an effect on you the rest of your life, you're going to have to start now. It's extremely important to start practicing good preventive medicine. For example, let's look at men 35 to 54 years of age. And what is the number one cause of death in men 35 to 54 years of age? It's heart disease. Number two is lung cancer. Number three is death from auto accidents. And number four is cirrhosis of the liver. Number five is strokes. I ask you now, how many of those causes of death are acts of man, and how many are acts of God? Let's take them in reverse. What's most commonly associated with a stroke? It's high blood pressure. And what in this country is very commonly associated with high blood pressure? Obesity. Being overweight. It was estimated in 1975 that there were 50 million Americans, almost 1 billion pounds overweight. I hope we don't sink. As an indictment of our fat population, and forgive me for saying that, when they renovated the Yankee Stadium and opened up in the summer of 1976, we noticed that the number of seats had decreased by almost 10,000. You know why? Yes, because they had to increase the widths of the seats from 18 to 22 inches to be able to handle the American people. That is an indictment of our society. There are at least 15 million Americans who have high blood pressure. And probably less than 25 or 30% are being treated. And the vast majority of those people, if they'll control their weight and exercise, they can control their blood pressure without medication. All right, what's the most common cause of cirrhosis of the liver? It's alcohol, without a question. And when you realize that there were 49 billion 12-ounce bottles of beer consumed in 1975 alone, now considering the other types of alcohol, we have a tremendous alcohol consumption in this country. Every day at our clinic in Dallas, we have a large number of executives primarily that go through the clinic, successful men. We do a whole series of blood studies, including 6 liver function studies. And we try to show these men, if we can, early, that they're showing some changes in their liver, characteristic of cirrhosis. And you can reverse it at that point because, you see, the Lord has given us a beautiful body. And it forgives us and forgives us and forgives us up to a point. It's amazing the way these cells can regenerate in so many cases. But yet you reach a point, and then it can't. It starts breaking down. And certainly the liver fits in that category. All right, what's the best way to prevent deaths from auto accidents? To reduce deaths from auto accidents? Use your seat belts and your shoulder harnesses. And yet it's estimated that in 1975, only 4% of the Americans used their shoulder harnesses, only 25% used their seat belts. You see, it'll always happen to the other person. It'll never happen to me. I have some protection. I would hesitate really to say this, but I think it's true, that probably the most deconditioned professional group of people that I see in my clinic in Dallas are ministers. I'm serious. But look at the stress on the minister's life. Look at the banquets, the eating, the obesity. I spoke last week at the School of Prophets in Dallas at First Baptist Church, and I was appalled at the size of the group, not the numbers, the individual size of the group. I challenge these ministerial people with the question, don't you feel that you have some divine protection from coronary disease? It doesn't work that way. And that's why we have a fairly high incidence of heart disease in people associated with the ministry. It can happen to you. You need to protect yourself. You need to practice preventive medicine. And one of the best ways to practice preventive medicine and have an effect on that number two cause of death is to eliminate cigarette smoking. There were at least 360,000 people who died in 1975 directly as a result of the use of tobacco. I'm talking about heart disease. I'm talking about lung disease. I'm talking about lung cancer. Of the 80,000 people who died from lung cancer in 1975, 72,000 had a history of cigarette smoking. If you smoke over one pack of cigarettes per day, it'll increase your resting heart rate at least 12 to 25 beats per minute in many cases. If you smoke over one pack of cigarettes per day, you're 3 times as likely to die of a heart attack as is the non-smoker, the pipe smoker, the cigar smoker, now listen to this, or the former cigarette smoker. You see, if you stop smoking cigarettes today, and I doubt if very few people here do smoke, but if you stop smoking cigarettes today, it takes 20 years before you can get back into the low-risk category as far as lung cancer is concerned that the non-smoker's in. But yet, if you stop smoking cigarettes today, it takes only 6 weeks to get back into the low-risk category as far as heart disease is concerned. It's not so much we die. We kill ourselves. An appalling statistic is this. Since 1969, the greatest increase in the use of tobacco in America has occurred in what? Young girls, 12 to 17 years of age. The greatest increase. A review just recently was conducted, an interview, to see who these people would expect, these young girls would expect not to smoke. They expected athletes not to smoke. They expected physicians not to smoke. But an appalling statistic, too, is the fact that some 70% of these girls said their physician had never said anything bad about cigarette smoking. We're falling down as physicians in providing the best service that we can to our patients and not teaching them how to practice preventive medicine. And as a result of this, the cost of medical care has risen from $12 billion in 1950 to $70 billion in 1970 to an estimated $150 billion in 1976. You can't pay for disease. You can't keep ahead. You've got to prevent disease if you're going to keep ahead in the game. It's appalling to me, too, to realize that since 1949, the U.S. government has subsidized the tobacco industry with $275 million to keep it alive. It doesn't make any sense. And number one on that list for men, number two for women, is heart disease. And we know now that if you practice good preventive medicine, that is proper weight, proper diet, proper exercise, avoiding tobacco, you can delay, at least delay the onset of heart disease, if you're not even preventing heart disease. I preach this message around the world. I talk about how we're killing ourselves. When a man dies, he does not die just of the disease he has. He dies of his entire life. You remember that today. As I've said several times, it's not that we die. We kill ourselves. What could we do if we practice good preventive medicine to try to counteract those five things that I mentioned? There's been great interest in jogging in this country. Since 1968, the number of joggers has increased almost 1,000-fold. How many joggers here today? Just do a show of hands. Fair number. You know, if you were students at ORU University, everyone in this group would raise their hand. That's right. Because, you know, Oral Roberts decided a few years ago that every student who comes to ORU is going to be required to participate in physical education 1 hour, four times a week for 4 years. Most colleges are phasing out physical education. No requirement at all. But since 1974, there's been a mandatory 30-point-a-week program for every male at ORU, faculty members included. And there's been a mandatory 24-point-a-week for every girl, faculty members included, at ORU. And they've got the most fantastically well-conditioned group of people I've ever seen in my life. And it's delightful to go up there. They have a new beautiful aerobic center. There are 3,000 students are required to participate almost every day. If you miss three successive weeks and don't get your points, you go on probation. If you don't get off probation, you'll be kicked out of school. Paul Roberts said this not long ago. He said, when a student graduates from ORU, he is spiritually fit, number one, academically fit, number two, and physically fit, number three, and you don't see much obesity at Oral Roberts University. There are things that you can do to stay ahead. Exercise, jogging, there's a whole series of things that you'll see during this presentation that you can use to keep yourself fit, to practice proper exercise. When I published the first book in 1968, there were a lot of newspaper and magazine releases on it. Of course, if you accomplished anything in life, it's going to be featured in the Reader's Digest, that famous medical journal. Not long ago, I read this comment in the Reader's Digest about jogging. A young man contacted his physician and said, "Doc," he said, "I've got a very poor relationship with my wife at home. We just feud and fuss all the time. How do you suggest that I improve this?" And the physician, being an aerobics fan, said, "I've got the answer to that. I would suggest that you go out and start jogging." He said, "Well, how far?" 10 miles. "How long?" 14 days. "See if that doesn't help." He said, "Man, that's tough. 10 miles a day for 14 consecutive days? He said that if it'll help, though, I'll try." 14 days later, the patient contacts the physician and said, "Doc, I did just what you told me to do. I've run 10 miles a day for 14 consecutive days." He said, "Did it help?" He said, "How do I know? I'm 140 miles from home." Some people just don't quite get the message. The man wrote once and said, "Dr. Cooper, I felt so much better after reading your book." He didn't do anything. He just read the book. Or the woman who wrote and said, "Dr. Cooper, I believe everything you say in your books is right. I watch my weight. I watch my diet. I exercise regularly. But I've got high blood pressure. I have heart disease. I've got arthritis. And I'm 85 years old. What'd I do wrong?" I felt like writing back and said, "You must have done something right. But I ask you this question. Are you doing something right at this critically important stage of your life? Are you practicing preventive medicine?" The American Health Foundation said this: "IRS is a legacy of a medical system providing too much care too late. And what you do now is going to affect you the rest of your life. Are you in shape?" Have the projector turned on, please. The system that we use in Dallas is this. We stress test a person to exhaustion to quantify his level of fitness. Those of you in physical education over the years, we've not had a means of quantifying fitness. But we do now by treadmill stress testing techniques, exercising someone to exhaustion using this particular protocol, standard speed, 3.3 miles per hour, increase the incline until we exercise a person to exhaustion. And then based on his response, we classify the individual into one of these categories: very poor, poor, fair, good, and excellent. Less than 30 years of age, 30 to 39, 40 to 49, 50 to 59, and 60 plus for both men and women. Yes, we are able to classify fitness using this type of technique. This has been a problem that we've had in the past, as I mentioned, that we couldn't quantify or classify fitness. But yet, now that we have done this, we've been able to take the 10 risk factors, coronary risk factors, listed by the American Heart Association, and see if they're related to your level of fitness. Let's go down these and see how many of you qualify for right now. The first one on the list is family history. You have a blood member of your family who had a heart attack less than 50 years of age. If you do, that's an increased coronary risk. Paul Dudley White once said, if you want to prevent heart disease, you must select the proper parent. And I think there is some truth to that. Number two, stress, personality behavior problems. I'm talking about the type A behavior in your heart, the famous book by Friedman. He says, if you're a type A, you've got to convert to a type B. Are you a type A? Let me ask you some questions. Do you salt your food before you taste it? If you can't stand for there to be a lull in the conversation and you finish sentence for someone, you're a type A. If it really bugs you to have to wait in line for anything, you're a type A. If it really bothers you to be defeated by a child in a game, you're a type A. If you shave or dictate in your car, you're a type A. Are you a knee jerker? Are you standing there now with your legs crossed and your foot's going back and forth? Type A behavior. Are you sitting on the edge of your seat? You're a type A. What do you do if you're a type A? There's an increased coronary risk. Dr. Friedman says become a type B. Change your personality. I dare you to do that. I challenge you to do that. As L.D. Pankey from Miami, Florida once said, a man can change his personality, but not much. And you know the best way to change your personality, become less depressed, become more enthusiastic, have more energy, but convert from a type A to a type B behavior pattern, is to exercise. That's true. I wish you could see our center in Dallas at 4:35 o'clock in the afternoon. We have almost 800 people a day exercising at our center, covering 1,200 to 1,300 miles every day on our track. The vast majority are top business people in Dallas, men and women alike, who have found the best way to protect themselves, to prevent heart disease, to be able to continue with their active productivity, is to exercise at the end of the day, burn up the stress of the day. Certainly number one and two are coronary risks. Number three, inactivity. Number four, blood pressure above 140 over 90 is a risk. Number five is abnormal resting ECG. Number six is being overweight. Number seven is cigarette smoking and then cholesterol, triglyceride, and glucose elevation. Those are accepted coronary risk factors. I'm going to show you in just a few minutes an amazing relationship between five of those coronary risk factors and your level of fitness. The glucose, the triglyceride, the cholesterol, your body weight, and your blood pressure. Here's number one. This is a slide in which we took 2,539 men, average age, 44.6 years, their first visit to our clinic. We determined their level of fitness, as you can see on the left, and classified them into the fitness category. Over on the right, we noticed that their blood sugar was directly related to their level of fitness. As you see, 112, 107, 105, 104, and 102. All right, there's a perfect correlation there between your susceptibility to heart disease from that coronary risk and perhaps your susceptibility to diabetes and your level of fitness. Let's take the second coronary risk. You see a very well-known coronary risk. You see cholesterol, same type of slide. Over on the left, the fitness categories. Over on the right, you see the level of cholesterol, which is an important risk factor. And you find a 237, 238, 228, 222, and 217. Only one of them is slightly out of line. The rest are directly in line. But you know you could do everything right as far as your diet was concerned. You control the intake of eggs and dairy products and the cholesterol-containing foods in the diet. And you compensate by tremendous input of such things as starches and carbohydrates, desserts, and bread and potatoes. Your cholesterol goes down, but your triglycerides go up. And triglycerides are also an important factor as far as heart disease is concerned. And you can see a perfect relationship there, 179, 172, 140, 114, and 87. Levels of fitness and triglycerides. There's three of them. What about the fourth one? Your body weight. And you can see that also is perfectly related with 196, 189, 182, 174, and 167. May I have the lights for just a minute, please? There's more behind weight than what meets the eye. The vast majority of people that come to our clinic in Dallas come for one of two reasons. They may be forced to come. That's another reason. Because their employer makes it mandatory for them to come down and go through our clinic and to get some motivation as far as their exercise and dietary programs are concerned. But the vast majority of people want to get in shape. They want to lose weight. But let me hasten to say, you girls here particularly, that you're not going to lose weight rapidly strictly with an exercise program. If you were to go out and to run 1 mile in 6 minutes and 15 seconds, you'll burn about 100 calories. If you want to lose 1 pound by running, you're going to have to run 35 miles at that speed. You can't do it. If you walk, you only burn about 65 or 70 calories per mile. And you've got to burn 3,500 calories to lose 1 pound. You can't do it. You've got to diet in conjunction with your exercise program to lose weight, if you want to lose it rapidly. All right, I'll fast. You fast and you'll find something else happens. You start destroying muscle mass as well as fat. What happens then when you start fasting, the body gets all confused. And the next thing you know, you're getting very weak. If you combine a low-calorie diet and an exercise program, all you destroy is fat. Our common denominator that we use in our clinic is a 1,200-calorie diet and 30 aerobic points per week. Understand this in just a few minutes. And you'll lose 2 pounds per week. And that's all we want you to lose. And we've got some classic examples of fantastic responses to this program. But even though you don't lose weight rapidly in response to an exercise program, you lose inches. Men tend to lose inches off of the waist. Women lose inches off of the waist and the hips and the thighs. They lose that secretarial spread in response to their exercise program. Let me give you an example. This 39-year-old woman wrote from Indiana and said this about her program. Dr. Cooper, when I started the program, I was in such poor condition that I could barely walk and run 1 mile in 12 minutes. Now, 1 year later, age 40, I can now run 1 3/4 miles in 12 minutes. That's the equivalent of running 2 miles in 13 minutes and 40 seconds. And that's pretty good for a 40-year-old woman. But she went on to say, when I started the aerobics program, I was a freak. I was size 12 from the waist up, size 20 from the waist down. She said, I was perfectly pear-shaped. The circumference of one of my thighs was larger than my waist. In response to 1 year of conditioning, she lost only 12 pounds, but she took 13 inches off of her hip. And she said something in her letter that impressed me. She said, you know, Dr. Cooper, I regain pride in the way I look. Think about that for a minute. Can you go home tonight and look at yourself in the mirror, full length preferably, and be proud of what you see? If you are, turn sideways and see if you're still proud. If you're still proud, bounce up and down on 1 foot and see if you can pass the jiggle test. Now, if you can pass the jiggle test, you may not be overweight. But there's a more sophisticated way of determining your ideal weight, and that's with this device. I call it a total body volumeter. The patients call it a whole series of names. But what it is a 7-foot vertical tank of water. Once you step on the platform, you're lowered down into the water. The water is at chin level. You take a deep breath in, let it all out, and go underwater. We get your volume by this technique. And knowing your volume and your weight, we get your specific gravity. We're trying to find out whether you sink or whether you float, because fat floats and muscle mass sinks. More specifically, we can tell you exactly what your ideal weight is. Because, you see, a man should be less than 19% body fat, and a woman should be less than 22% body fat. And with this technique, we can tell you exactly what your percent body fat is. For example, I run 16% body fat. Roger Staubach with the Dallas Cowboys at 196 pounds is 11% body fat. Some of these big football players weighing 240 pounds who are just solid muscle are as low as 9 and 10% body fat. It's amazing, yes. About a year and a half ago, we had 20 world-class runners to come to our research institute in Dallas, including Frank Shorter, Kenny Moore, the late Steve Prefontaine, world-class marathoners primarily. We found that the average percent body fat among those world-class runners was 4.4%. And one man, Gary Tuttle, was 1.14% body fat. Have you ever seen a walking skeleton? No, it wasn't that. They're lean, very, very lean. Wouldn't you like to know your ideal body weight? You probably think you have big bones and you can tolerate more weight than those charts allow you to tolerate. That's what the most of our patients think. But of course, we can prove or disprove that particular thought when they come to our clinic. But of course, there might be some problems if you came to our clinic for an ideal body weight determination, because if you can't swim, it might be a problem. Or if you suffer from claustrophobia, it might be a problem because that tank is not very large. So our technicians always brief the patients by asking them two questions. Do you swim, number one, and do you suffer from claustrophobia, number two? The vast majority of people, no problem. I can only recall two problems in the last few years. The first one occurred in a man who weighed 300 pounds. Now, you have to appreciate that that tank is not large at the top. It's kind of like a Coke bottle. It's large at the bottom. And we couldn't get his stomach through the top. So we greased him up and pushed him into the tank. Now, see, once you get in that tank, there's no way of getting out because there's no ladder, steps, or anything else. You have to have the elevator to get out. We made all of our measurements, flipped the switch to activate the elevator to bring him back out, and the cable supporting the elevator broke. And we had a nude, 300-pound, slimy man stuck in the bottom of that tank. It took us almost 45 minutes to get him out, about the same way we got him in. Let me hasten to say that we now have a winch set up, so if that happens again, we can crank him out of the tank. That's case number one. Case number two was this man. He said, "Dr. Cooper, I suffer from claustrophobia. I can't stand tight places. I don't know if I can tolerate that or not, but I'd sure like to know my ideal weight." And I said, "Fine, I'll test you myself." So I took him out, put him on the elevator, lowered him down to water, water at chin level, and I heard this voice, just about like this, coming out of the bottom of the tank. "Dr. Cooper, I want out." And I said, "Fine." I flipped the switch to bring him out, but he was already out. That's impossible. You can't get out of that tank without assistance. But he did. He looked like, so one of our technicians said, he looked like a Polaris missile being blasted out of a tub in a submarine when he came out of that tank. But I can assure you, you can do some amazing things when you're frightened. But we can do some things with this tank that are interesting. For example, look at this man. You see, he started off weighing 247 pounds. He was 40% body fat. I told him that he had at least 47 pounds to lose, and he lost down to 196 pounds and was still 21% body fat. That's what we see characteristically. But here's an example of something you might not expect. And here's a man who weighed 155 and a quarter pounds when he started and 155 and a quarter pounds when he finished. But he started off at 21% body fat, and he ended up at 13% body fat. He lost 4 inches off of his waist and didn't lose a pound. He converted fat into muscle mass. And you can do that, the program of this type. And as you would expect, this fourth factor, obesity, percent body fat, is directly related to your level of fitness. The percent body fat, 29, 26, 23, 20, and 18. And the final coronary risk factor is this, your systolic blood pressure, perfectly related to your level of fitness, as you see in some 3,000 men. 132, 126, 124, 122, and 122, and so is your diastolic pressure, as you can see here. 86, 83, 83, 80, and 79. What's the best way to motivate people in America? Money. That's right. And we have pending at the present time before the Texas State Insurance Commission a super select life insurance policy. And if you can classify, you can qualify for super select insurance, you may be the recipient of a 25 to a 40% reduction in your annual life insurance premium. And this is how you qualify. This is an example of how you qualify for super select life insurance. You must go longer than 15 minutes on the treadmill. That means you can run 2 miles in 20 minutes. You girls can do that fairly easily to get in shape. Stress ECG must be normal. Blood pressure must be less than 140 over 90. Cholesterol must be less than 250. Triglycerides less than 150. Your glucose less than 110. You can't smoke at all. We try to use 10 cigarettes a day, but you can't use that. And finally, if you're a man, less than 22% body fat. A woman, less than 19% body fat. May I have the lights, please? I've given you some background fairly rapidly here on the need for conditioning and training. I want to conclude this morning with two things. One is to tell you what you need to do to get in shape. I want to answer three questions. Number one, what kind of exercise do you need? Because remember that exercise can be used in three general areas. Rest and relaxation. Muscle building and figure contouring. Cardiovascular pulmonary conditioning. There's only one of those that's going to save your life. Add quality years onto your life. And remember this. Three things accelerate aging in this order. Number one, cigarette smoking. Number two is inactivity. And number three is obesity. You can do something about how fast you age. You can do something about your problems with the diseases of an affluent society. Exercise is one. We answered that question years ago. The only type of exercise that will consistently build up the cardiovascular system is aerobic type exercise, walking, running, cycling, and swimming, endurance type exercises. But the second question had to be answered. Is there a way to compare these exercises? And to answer that question, we went back to our research lab back in the early 60s in San Antonio, Texas, where I was stationed in the Air Force. And we ran a series of men and women on the treadmill, And we exercised them at various speeds and collected the expired air to determine the energy cost. And found, as you see on the left, the mile times. Down the center, the calories they burn per minute. And over on the right, the oxygen consumption. And that oxygen consumption increased by a multiple of 7. And lo and behold, we had a foundation for the aerobic point system, which is based on that multiple of 7. For example, if you walk that mile between 14:30 and 20 minutes, it's worth 1 point. But if you run that mile under 6:30, it's worth 6 points. The more energy you put into your effort, to your exercise, the more points you get. All right, I don't want to walk or run. I want to cycle, as the people in the Air Force said. All right, we'll study cycling. We didn't study it in a laboratory. There's too many variables. We went out into the field. We hooked a man up with a telemetry system so he could monitor his heart rate continuously. We had a man in the back of a pickup truck collecting the expired air to determine the energy cost, monitoring electrocardiogram, monitoring the wind resistance. And can't you imagine the remarks that we had with this system as we cycled around San Antonio, Texas? The most frequently asked question was, what are you feeding that guy, Doc, anyway? But we got a point system for cycling based on speed under 10 miles an hour is restful and relaxing, girls. Over 20 miles an hour, men, is racing speed. But you see, 10 to 15 miles an hour is worth a half a point per mile. What is the single best aerobic exercise? No, it's not swimming. It's cross-country skiing. But it's kind of hard to cross-country ski in Shawnee, Oklahoma, like it is in Dallas, Texas. And right behind cross-country skiing, I'd put swimming based on the speed and the stroke. We award points. Other ways you can get your aerobic points by competitive sports. Handball, basketball, squash, soccer. The fastest growing sport in America today, racquetball. It's true. Worth 9 points per hour. Tennis, 4.5 points per hour. Singles only, players of equal ability. Football, 6 points per hour. Downhill skiing, 6 points per hour. Considering the time only that you're skiing, cross-country skiing worth 24 points per hour. We have 28 exercises now that qualify for aerobic points. But the final question then had to be answered, how many points a week do you need? And the answer for men was 30. The answer for women was 24 points a week. But don't make a mistake when you start into a conditioning program. Don't try to get all your points the first week. That's why, as was mentioned in the introduction, some 200 schools are using the aerobics program. And you have to progress through a 6-week starter program, and then 10, 13, 16 weeks of progressive exercise. Work up to your level of fitness. Your heart might tolerate it, but your legs and your muscles won't tolerate it. And those of you who have not been exercising or go out and try to run a mile tonight are foolish. I recommend for the first 3 weeks, anyone who's not been conditioning regularly, that they walk a mile the first week, 5 days a week. They walk a mile and a half the second week, 5 days a week. And the third week, they walk 2 miles before they ever start doing any jogging at all. And if you will do that, you'll build up the muscles even though you're 25 years of age. And the problems with jogging deaths are realistic. In people past 35 years of age, particularly past 40 years of age, who have heart disease and don't know it, and that's why we strongly encourage anyone past 40 years of age at least to have a stress test and to be stress tested to at least this level of fitness age adjusted. Because you see, 12% of the people who come to our clinic in Dallas have a perfectly normal resting EKG, have no history of heart disease, and yet the stress test reveals that they have serious underlying heart disease. And those are your people who will die while jogging, while playing tennis, while sitting at home and watching TV. We've got at least 27 million cardiac patients in America today. A lot of you people here today have heart disease. You may not know it, but you do. And if you start an exercise program, if you have heart disease, we may restrict you. We may restrict you to walking. Walking's a fantastic exercise. It just takes longer. You'd have to work up, as you can see over on the left, 3 miles in less than 43:30, 5 times a week is worth 30 points. And the only advantage that running has is you get more benefit in a shorter period of time, a mile and a half in less than 12 minutes, 4 times a week is worth 30 points. But that's too fast for the average individual. And that's the reason the bottom one on that list is the most popular program that we have in America today for our jogging program. And that's 2 miles in less than 20 minutes. And you do that 4 times a week, and you get at least 32 points. Other ways, cycling 5 miles in less than 20 minutes, 6 times a week. Swimming 800 yards in less than 20 minutes 5 times a week. Competitive sports, an hour and a half, 3 times a week. Just giving you some rapid examples here. But the most important part of the program is this. You can vary it. You can walk, you can run, you can cycle, you can swim. I don't care what you do, as long as you work up to at least 30 points a week if you're a man, and 24 points a week if you're a woman. But Doc, I've got excuses. I can't exercise. I'm too old. I'm too young. I'm a young lady. I'll lose my figure. I have fallen arches. I get blisters on my feet. I can't get shoes to fit. You give me an excuse, and I've heard that excuse at least 1,000 times. If I tell my patients, and they come to me and say, well, Doc, you know, I've been awfully busy over the last 6 months. I haven't been able to do anything. I've been working very, very hard, and I've been traveling all over the country and all that. And I say, yes, sir, I can understand. But can your heart understand? Finally, this morning, I want to show you some examples of people who would not accept excuses. And if you've got one that'll top these, I want to hear it. First, Harvard professor, never been an athlete, but at age 32 he started jogging. At age 39 he was finishing his 7th Boston Marathon, averaging better than 7 minutes a mile for the 26 miles, 385 yards. The man who won the Boston Marathon that year was from Belgium, 28 years of age, and he ran the distance of 26 plus miles, averaging 5 minutes and 12 seconds a mile. Frank Shorter, Sierpinski, that group, are averaging 4 minutes and 56 seconds a mile when they run their 2-hour and 9-minute marathon. What is the capacity of this marvelous body that the Lord gave? We don't really know yet. Yes, I've had an interest in marathon running over the years because I had the chance to run the Boston Marathon twice. All I can say about that picture taken by my wife at the end of the race is I felt about the same way I looked. And one reason I felt so bad is I'd worked for so hard and so long, and I came in 1 hour behind 57-year-old Johnny Kelly, finishing his 35th Boston Marathon, averaging 6 minutes and 30 seconds a mile. Aging and performance don't leave out Pop Kepner from Houston, Texas, who at age 65 was told he better retire because of heart disease and arthritis, but to the contrary, he started exercising, he started cycling, and at age 67, he cycled from Houston to New York City, averaging 140 miles a day. He came to San Antonio, 1966, and entered a bicycle race, a 64-mile bicycle race. There were 32 contestants in the race. 31 were under 25 years of age. This man at that time was 70 years of age. He came in 9th. How would you like to have been one of those young men when they were passed by this 70-year-old man on a bicycle? If that would have been insane. I'm too old, I'm too young. What about this little boy, Condi Pugh from California? Age 4. When I took this picture, he was running his mile nonstop in 10 minutes in the 4th lane, barefooted. When this picture was taken, this little 6-year-old girl had just finished running 10 miles nonstop in 93 minutes, averaging a little over 9 minutes a mile. You lose your figure? What about this marathoner? My name is Elaine Peterson, United Airlines stewardess, and all she allows me to say about her is she's over 30 years of age. Or what about the girl who for a long time held the world's record for marathons for women, Cheryl Bridges, who ran a 2-hour and 44-minute marathon? You runners can appreciate that. But you know, without question, one of the most startling examples I've ever seen, as far as overcoming problems, was this man. His name was Pete Strudwick. At age 39, I first met Pete when he was running in the Witness to Fitness in Long Beach, California. And I saw him that afternoon run 2 miles in less than 16 minutes without any feet. Look at number 402, and you see that he runs on studs. He doesn't put on running shoes. He tapes sponge rubber cushions to those studs. And a few weeks after that, he ran and successfully completed a 26-mile marathon. If that wasn't enough, nearly 1970, he entered and successfully completed the most difficult road race in the world, the Pikes Peak Marathon. He ran 13 and a half miles up the mountain and 13 and a half back on studs. I was lecturing a few years ago in San Francisco. A man came up after the presentation that night and said, Dr. Cooper, my name is Harry Cordellis. I'm 32 years of age, and just a few weeks ago, I ran 10 miles in 63 minutes. Good. Not too unusual for a man 32 years of age, except for the fact that Harry Cordellis has been blind since birth. And he has to run by rubbing elbows with someone. And a few weeks after that, he sent me a letter and said, Dr. Cooper, I want to let you know that I entered and successfully completed the Golden Gate Marathon. I ran 26 miles, 385 yards, and only fell down twice. Since that time, he's run over 30 marathons, and last year became the first American blind man in history to break 3 hours for a marathon. He runs, he swims, he dives, he does everything. He's been blind since birth. A San Francisco article just recently said this. For Harry Cordellis, blindness is not a handicap. It is merely an inconvenience. Slide off, please. This morning, I hope I've motivated you. I hope in this very short time I've educated you. But I hope I've made you think about your own life. I can assure you, the way you die is going to depend upon the way you live. I can't guarantee a person here today that if you exercise regularly, control your diet, your weight, you'll live one day longer. But I can assure you, you'll live a happier and a healthier and a more productive life. And we are challenged to glorify God in our bodies as well as our spirits, the temple of the Lord. Are you glorifying God in your body? Thank you very much.